Blog Talk Radio.
Pour yourself a cup of tea, put your feet up, and relax. Show host Randy Fine, narcissistic abuse expert, compassionate counselor for clients worldwide, and author of the groundbreaking new book, Close Encounters of the Worst Kind, invites you into her sanctuary, a place where your emotional, physical, and spiritual well-being are all that matters. Time to Heal is a fundraising single written and performed by Johnny Z for the Amy Winehouse Foundation. For more information, please go to johnnymusic.com, johnnymusic.com. And now, it's time to meet Randy, show host of the podcast enjoyed by fans around the globe, A Fine Time for Healing.
Good morning. Thank you for tuning in to listen to A Fine Time for Healing. I am Randy Fine, your show host. I just want to start off the show by remembering the 18th year anniversary of September 11th, that terrible tragedy on American soil that shook the world, really. Last year, I had, if you look back to my shows for 9/11 2018, I had two guests on. One was a survivor, and the other was a therapist who counseled the responders. And they're very, very interesting interviews. So I suggest that you, you know, take a listen, or you know, go back to 9/11 2018 and listen to those interviews. But you know, every year, I'm just so affected by this. I remember the day. I think we all do. We know where we were. You know, it's like one of those things. So just take a minute and honor them today. Honor the people whose lives were lost and the families. Pray for the families. Today, we're going to talk about TEPP, T-E-P-P. Now, you don't know what that is, and we're going to explain it because the expert today is Philip Shepherd. In a stressful chronic world, many people feel as though their brain is restless and they can't get out of the cycle of their own thoughts. That's why Philip Shepherd, today's special guest, author and bodywork expert, developed a new mindfulness technique, the Embodied Present Process, or TEPP, T-E-P-P. This is a new style of mindfulness training, taking the focus from listening to your body and shifting the focus toward listening to yourself through the actions and feelings within the body. Philip Shepherd is recognized as an international authority on embodiment. His unique techniques have been developed to transform our experience of self and world, and are based on the vision articulated in his celebrated books, New Self, New World, and Radical Wholeness. So I'm going to introduce you to Philip so we can get started and find out exactly what TEPP is. Good morning, Philip, and welcome to the show.
Good morning, Randy. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
It's a pleasure to be with you. So tell us a little bit about yourself and your background first, and how you came to this practice.
Yeah, the origins of it really go back to my teenage years, because I looked around me at the adults running the world, and it seemed to me they were stuck in a fantasy, playing roles that were actually suffocating their lives. And I couldn't effectively put language to it, but I could feel my own life being bit by bit molded into that same role playing. And I understood that what I was trying to fight against was my own culture. Because you're born into a culture as an innocent baby, and you take into your body messages about what it means to be human, what reality is, and you take those to be normal. You mistake the story for the reality, and then you end up living out that story, feeling disconnected from reality and not knowing why. So when I was 18, I left my home in Toronto, Canada, and went to England and bought a bicycle and headed off on it for Japan. And I cycled through Europe and the Middle East and India and Japan, and passed through so many different ways of understanding what it means to be human. And that liberated me to come back to my culture 2 years later and begin to question the assumptions that I'd taken into my body before I was old enough to even ask a question. And that's really the foundation that led to TEP over many decades.
That's so fascinating. In your book, Radical Wholeness, you talk about how we have five senses that in our culture, but that other cultures don't use the same senses. Can you just speak about that, talk about that a little bit, elaborate on that?
Yeah, I'd be happy to, because we, you know, again, it's one of the assumptions. You're a kid, you're told you have five senses. Oh, yes, that makes sense. And then it turns out, as you say, that other cultures experience the senses very differently. What distinguishes our five senses is pretty interesting. Every one of our senses follows this model. A stimulus from the world passes the boundary of the self, arrives on a receptor, and is sent to the brain for interpretation. And so, you know, light passes through into the eye, heat passes into the skin, sound into the ear, whatever it is. So all of our senses uphold the idea that we are contained within a boundary. There is a sense, for example, the Anglo-Ewe culture in Africa has as their primary sense the sense of balance. And you think, well, that's kind of interesting, because we talk about a sense of balance. There's an organ devoted to the sense of balance in the inner ear. Why don't we accept it as a sense? Well, balance is a felt relationship between you and the center of the earth. And there's not, you know, it's not a matter of upholding the boundary of the self. There's nothing that crosses any boundary in balance. It's you are held in that relationship in every moment of your life. And so you begin to look at the Anglo-Ewe, for example, and they don't have a word as such for sense. What they have is a word, sesalalame, and sesalalame means feel at flesh inside. So It's a sense that everything in the world is felt through the body. When they hear, you know, they have a word that means just to listen with the ear, but that's not real listening. When you're truly listening, you're hearing the sounds of the world in the body. You're feeling them in the body. And similarly with sight, and similarly with every other sense. And there are senses they have that for us aren't senses at all. The woman whose work really led me to the Anglo Eve is Catherine Lynn Geertz. And she talked about going to the Anglo Eve and asking them about their senses. And she explained what she meant by a sense. And they started listing their senses. And then they said, and speech is a sense. And she said, oh, just a minute. I don't think I've explained what I mean by a sense very clearly. Let me try again. So she explained what she meant by a sense. Excuse me. And they said, yes, yes, and speech. So for us, it's inconceivable that speech should be a sense, because for us, speech is a means of receiving information, a means of giving information to the world, and
right.
A sense receives information. But I think the Anglo Eve are nearer the truth, because the idea that you speak to deliver sort of a prepackaged idea is absurd. When I launch into a sentence, I don't know what the last word of the sentence is going to be. I don't necessarily know where the sentence is going to take me. Every word, every phrase is moving me forward in the same way that when I step into a dark room, my sense of touch will lead me safely into the room. So in that regard, you can certainly see that speech is a sense every bit as much as touch is. So that's, you know, those are a few examples.
That's so interesting. You know, when you're talking about balance, you know, I'm picturing in my mind these cultures who carry things on their head, these amazing big things that they carry on their head. And I always wondered how they did that. But if balance is something that is a crucial sense from the time that they're born, then that makes sense. We could not go around carrying big baskets of fruit on our head. It wouldn't work. We drop
them. No, I mean, yeah. And Catherine Lynn Geertz, in her book, Culture and the Senses, talks about, you know, she had to fill her water barrel and the kids helped out. And there's three-year-old Tommy pitching in, balancing a pan of water on his head from the well to her water barrel. And you know, I'm thinking that three-year-old kid could do it. And I don't, as you say, I don't think I could do it. But there's a larger implication, because when they place balance as the primary sense, it goes beyond just that sense of alignment with the earth. It also implicates balance in your relationships, in your family, in your community, with nature. And you look at it from that perspective, and you consider our culture, which, you know, denies balance any status as a sense, and you think, well, my gosh, there's no area in which balance is needed, and would improve everything.
Right. I mean, the practice of yoga does bring you back to balance. That's one of the things. So I guess in that culture, that must have been one of the, I don't know if it was a sense, but obviously it was important. So let's talk about your the embodied present process, or TEPP, T-E-P-P. What is that?
The embodied present process is a series of practices that, well, they liberated me from those assumptions that live in our body, and it turns out they help liberate others too, which I find very gratifying. There's a sense in our culture of the brain being the almighty ruler of the self, and so we tend to live in our heads. And our obsession in life as a culture is to organize. And we organize the self. We organize our ideas. We organize our emotions. We organize our relationships. We organize our careers. There's nothing we don't organize in that top-down manner, from the head knowing what should be done and asserting itself on either the self or the world around it. So even when we strive to become more embodied, and I think there's a wide recognition that we in some way have to come back to the body's intelligence. But even then, you know, we choose to listen to the body. We take the route of forging that attention given to the body. And in a way, that more deeply entrenches us in disembodiment, because the metaphor of listening to the body basically is telling you that your body is in the room next door and there's a wall separating you from it. And the best you can do is to put your ear to that wall to listen to what's happening on the other side. So this cultural imperative that we should live in the head even eclipses our ability to reunite with the body's intelligence. So my work isn't about listening to the body. It's about listening to the world through the body. And that happens when the body is able to restore its natural spaciousness. And we, you know, our bodies become so congested that it feeds our self-absorption like a closed loop. And we organize more intensely and feel that organization getting out of control, and anxiety is created. And it's such a different thing to recover that spaciousness within the body. And there's even a sense of opening to the world around you such that you feel yourself being organized by the present. And the present is teeming with information. And that, to be that deeply informed that you are being organized by that information and you're attuning to it, is to bring a sense of ease and clarity and belonging back into your life. And that's really what the practices of TEP move us towards.
So that's just brilliant. I mean, it's such an interesting way to look at our existence and, you know, how we fit into this world. And I've never really heard anybody, you know, put it like that, but it makes total sense. It takes a lot of fear and pressure off of us if we just allow everything to come in rather than running our lives. I mean, I can definitely see that. How do we break free of what we're used to doing, though?
Well,
no, he laughs.
it's not a simple thing, because the habits of thinking and being run so deeply. And you know, I deeply, deeply believe that given the challenges we face as a species, what we most deeply need is to find a new way of being. Because the way of being to which we're married at the moment is one of consumption and self-absorption. And even when we try to correct the damage we've done, our tendency is to do it in a top-down manner. And top-down thinking doesn't feel. The brain doesn't feel. A surgeon can cut open the brain without using anesthetic because it doesn't feel. And so we've got this hypervigilant thinking about what should be done. And in the meantime, we have incapacitated our ability to feel the world. And if you can't feel the world, you can't come into harmony with it. And if you can't come into harmony with the world then your every action will in some way do secondary damage to it, even when the intentions are benevolent. So how do you do it? It's, you know, it begins by recognizing that our intelligence isn't confined in the head. Our bodies teem with intelligence. And the reality is that, you know, we've anointed our conscious thinking as the sort of almighty governing force within our lives. Our conscious minds are aware of 1/1,000,000,000 of the information that is being processed through the body. So we've put a crown on 1/1,000,000,000 of our intelligence and denied ourselves access to the other 999 million parts of our intelligence that are coursing through us. And it's not that you come into union with that intelligence and structure it in a linear way. You can't objectively know all that information that the body is feeling, but you can feel it. You can land in the present, release your breath to the present, and feel it. And as you feel it, you're feeling the waves of information that are passing through you and attuning to them. And then your choices are guided by that reality, are in harmony with that reality, rather than being implemented by this segregated portion of the intelligence in the head. And that's a big difference, that sense of being guided in your life. As long as you live in the head and you've dulled yourself to what is passing through the body, all you can do is guide yourself because you don't feel the guidance of the present. So it's only as you drop down and reunite with the body's intelligence, so you are now like the Anglo Ewe, hearing the world through the body. You're feeling the sounds of the world in the body. You're feeling the sights of the world in the body, and you're feeling the core of your thinking in the body.
It's a much healthier way to exist. I mean, I can really see that. I know that with working with people who have suffered abuse, one of the things that causes them to be stuck in this rut of thinking is that they are more in their head than they are in their intuition. So I get that because we're taught when we go through this particular kind of abuse to think a certain way. We're trained, we're brainwashed to think a certain way. And the only way to get out of that is to get out of your head and into your intuition. So I can really see how, you know, when I expand this the way that you have expanded it, I can really see how that would be so much more healthy for us. Now, if we say that we achieve that, and I guess we'll talk about, you know, how you train people next, but say that we achieve that, how do we go about functioning in this world? Because if we have jobs that expect us to be in our head, how do we do that? How do we function?
Yeah, I mean, it's such a great question because it sort of points back to an assumption that has been trained into us systematically that's actually, I think, quite erroneous. And that assumption is that you can think more clearly, more effectively, if you shut off all that information teeming through the body. And you think of the ultimate purpose or the ultimate aim of the education system. And you take a little child and you sit them in a chair at a desk and you tell them, don't let your body's energy get out of control. If it does, you're going to get in trouble. Suppress the body's energy, which is the same as saying suppress the body's intelligence, and fill your head with the right answers. So we are teaching our kids that you can think more effectively with a small segregated portion of your intelligence than you can with the intelligence of your entire being. So it's not, you know, coming back to the intelligence of the body isn't a matter of denying or shutting off the abstractions of the head. It's a matter of bringing those abstractions into relationship with what the body knows so that they're tuned and clarified by that. And you can go into the most abstract realm. So there's a really interesting researcher, John Coates, who was a Wall Street trader and became a neuroscientist. And he went back to Wall Street to study a curious phenomenon, because once in a while, he would make a trade and just know that that trade was going to be successful. Like, just he just knew it was, and sure enough, it was. And he said, well, what's that about on a neuroscientific level? And let's inquire into it. So he did a series of experiments with traders that definitively showed that traders who are more in touch with their bodies are more effective, more successful traders. And traders who've been around for 20, 30 years are more in touch with their bodies than the average trader. So even the ability to survive in the stock market means that you better be in touch with what the body knows, because if you're relying on the calculations of the head, you're going to fall on your face. So, you know, I don't know of a more abstract realm than high-frequency stock trading. And even there, the intelligence of the body is a moderating influence that knows beyond what the conscious mind can know the verity of a situation. And so you think of transporting that ability into any realm, to be able to think with the whole of your being rather than with that secluded portion of your thinking, is always an asset. I can't think of one instance in which it's not.
It's hard to imagine thinking with your body. So the only way that I know about thinking with my body is instincts, gut feelings, those kind of things. What other information is coming in, and how is it coming in? Is this a spiritual or a universal thing, energetic information? What is the information that we're getting?
It's such a great question. We are trained into binary thinking by our culture. So I can think with my head, or I can think from my heart and feel from my heart, but they don't go together. Or I can have a gut instinct, or I can be analytical, but they don't go together. So there is this primary wound that our culture has inflicted on each one of us. And that is the wound between our thinking and our being. They belong together, but we have sundered them apart. And when you begin to bring them back together, you get out of that either or situation. And instead of just thinking in the head, you begin to feel every thought, and your every thought resonates through the spaciousness of your being and is clarified through that resonance by the intelligence of the body. So you feel your thinking. And on the other hand, every sensation that you have is recognized as a form of thinking. The body thinks in sensation. And so thinking and being become one thing again, which you know, every child is born into that unity. And it's only through the systematic institutionalization of the body that they're pulled apart. And you go back, you know, there's a Latin word, sentire, which means to think, to feel. They are the same thing within this word. And sentire led to the English word sense. So you can say, you're not making sense to someone. And what you're saying is your reasoning is faulty. So that's like the thinking of the head. Or you can say, you know, I sense that something's not right, which is a feeling. And so even in English, you know, the word sense still kind of couples those two poles of our intelligence together. But it's just a vestige of the unity into which we were born.
This is such an amazing concept. It's so hard to understand. It makes total sense, but it's so hard to understand. So the embodied present process, is this, do you have workshops? How do you train people to listen to our bodies?
Yeah, I do have workshops. And more than workshops. So I most frequently teach a weekend workshop, and I travel all over with that, around the world, from Australia to Europe to North America. And I also have intermediate workshops, which are 5-day workshops. And I run facilitators trainings, which is really, for me, the most exciting part of the work, because you come together with a group of people who are really committed. They're each there for their own reasons, but they're potent reasons. And we come together for 3 5-day retreats over the period of a year, where we just do a deep dive together into the healing of that schism, where we insist on thinking with the head and shutting down the body, and how to bring them together, how to heal that wound between them. And between those 5-day retreats, there are weekly Zoom calls or video calls. So I'll issue a question or an exploration for them to consider over the week, and we get together and I'll talk everyone through a new meditative practice, and then we have a discussion around the issue that's been sent out. So it really takes that immersion, that regular reminder to help people extricate themselves into a kind of freedom that is not impaired by those cultural assumptions. And the purpose of the facilitator's training, I mean, the overarching purpose is to help people facilitate the work, but a lot of people come to it who don't at all see themselves as facilitators. They're just coming for their own personal reasons. And really the underlying challenge we all face is how to live the work, how to model it, how to grow into that other way of being, where you don't feel boundaried from the world and trapped within your skin, but you open to its currents and feel its companionship. So the facilitator's training is sort of it's like the icing on the cake. It's such a wondrous journey to take over the period of a year with this group of people who by the end of the year are as close as family.
And I can see how it could take all that support affirmation and unity and all those kind of things to change that. Because as we're sitting here, as we're talking, you know, I'm thinking, my head is feeling tight. As we're talking, I'm becoming very aware of the boundaries of my thinking in a very physical way, which I've never really felt before.
That's fabulous, Randy. Because if you don't feel it, you don't have choice. But once you do feel it, then it's already started to change in some way. It's like you can't become newly aware of something without affecting it, without changing it. In the same way that in physics, you can't observe anything without affecting it. So just the act of noticing, that's already the beginning of it.
Cool. Wow.
And
well,
the work is about remembering as well. You know, I think our lives, the path of our lives is shaped by a tug of war between the desire to forget and the desire to remember. And this work is really about remembering. So it does take that consistent support to really come along, as you were saying.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. Wow. So you hold these workshops worldwide. Is there a website that people can go to connect with you?
Yeah, I have a website that's my name, philipshepherd.com. Philip with one L and Shepherd, like the guy who looks after sheep. And that has a list of all the workshops I'm giving. And also, it has so much material that people, you know, blogs and essays that people can, and interviews that people can delve into just to get a sense for themselves. I'm also launching a course on another website, which is tep.life. So there's a course called Reconnect to Yourself, Reconnecting to Yourself, and that's just being launched this week. So
people could
also check out that. Yeah, I'm thrilled about that.
So what is that website?
That's tep.life, T-E-P-P dot life.
Life, L-I-F-E.
L-I-F-E, yeah. And it's, you know, what I'm hoping is it's the beginning of a way of supporting people in the work without me having to be there in person, which of course dramatically reduces my ability to help people because you can only be in front of so many people at a time.
Now, when you were talking about facilitators, so do you train people to do what you do to conduct these or is that kind of a goal, to conduct these workshops so that you can be out there more? Or is it really just you doing them?
No. Other people have been trained to do the work. I've got a facilitator's training starting in Toronto in October and one starting in Austria in June. And people are sharing the work around the world. There's a hub of activity in Ireland, and there are people in the States, and it's a little challenging because people feel frustrated and they feel anxious and the question they ask is, what's wrong with me? And the question that needs to be asked is, what's wrong with my culture? And it's such a difficult question to pose because we take it to be normal. And it's actually historically a huge aberration to enclose your thinking in your head and deny the body's intelligence. We wouldn't have survived as a species, as hunter-gatherers, if we weren't able to attune to the natural world and come into harmony with it. So, the very intelligence that made our survival possible is the one we've now turned our backs on.
Yeah, I'm thinking about my daughter when she was, before she started going to school and learning to write and everything, She could write with both hands at one time, mirror images. She could write words, mirror images like that. And the other thing was she had imaginary friends, which were, I'm sure, were guides because they were very, very real. But all those things disappeared when she got to school and was told how to do things, how to write, how to think. It all disappeared, you know. And I definitely made note of that. And, you know, it was kind of upsetting to see that go away. But that's kind of an example of where the programming, you know, where we're being taught to do something a certain way that's not really our natural inclination. That really kind of reminds me of that.
Absolutely. And I mean, it's heartbreaking. I mean, it just is to see that sensitivity being dulled and forgotten. And the other thing that school does is it focuses our attention on answers. So you succeed if you come up with the right answers. You memorize the information and come up with the necessary response. And school does nothing to teach us how to pose a question. And I think that ability to feel the world around you and look at it and pose a question is what will liberate your being into the reality. And so we have, you know, we have a populace that will glom onto an answer because it feels right, without the ability to step back and poke at it and test it and hold it to account. And then, you know, politicians, of course, take advantage of that by giving people the answers they want to hear and winning votes as a result. And to me, it goes back to the institutionalized enforcement of head-based thinking that is obsessed with answers and is dulled to that slippery, acute facility for holding something to account and questioning it.
Oh, well, thank you so much for coming on today and expanding our minds this way. And, you know, when I say that, you know, then I'm like, well, that's how I would normally say it. We would expand our minds, but expand the way we receive the world. I think that's a better way to say it, right?
And I think that is the mind. I think, you know, the mind suffuses not just the body, but the world around us. And attuning to mind is a beautiful thing. It's so different from being stuck in the brain.
Okay. Gotcha. Gotcha. That's good. Thank you for clarifying that. But anyway, it's been really, really interesting. I've really enjoyed talking to you, Philip. And I'm sure my listeners are really enjoying this and will, you know, when they listen to the recordings. So I appreciate so much you being my guest today. Thank you.
It's been a joy, Randy. Thank you so much.
Be well. Take care. Have a great day.
Thanks. You too.
Thanks. Bye-bye. So we are out of time today, but if you have any comments or questions, you can email me at loveyourlife@randyfine.com, R-A-N-D-I. May joy and serenity always be yours. Goodbye.